You can get 3 months of The Spectator for just £15, plus a free bottle of Paul Roger champagne if you go to spectator.co.uk/fizz24. This offer is UK only and subject to availability.
Hello and welcome to The Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, a literary editor of The Spectator, and my guest this week is the writer Daniel Tammet, whose new book is Nine Minds, Inner Lives on the Spectrum, which is a pen portraits of nine lives of people who are in the autism spectrum or Asperger's syndrome. Daniel, thank you for joining us. Can you start by telling me, how did you choose these nine lives?
Yes. Well, nine, because it's a nice number. It goes well with minds, nine minds. Not too many, and at the same time, just enough to show the diversity, the enormous diversity, in fact, within the spectrum. And the people were all individuals who had spoken publicly at some point about their autism. Obviously, that's essential because I needed to be able to have them speak to me rather intimately about their experiences, their inner lives as well, their dreams, their hopes, their fears, the obstacles they've had to overcome, some quite traumatic experiences for some of them. So I needed them to have spoken publicly, to be confident and comfortable speaking publicly about their autism. One of the people actually came to me. I wasn't looking out for her, Amanda, the Australian in the book. She'd written a thesis, a doctoral thesis, about a wonderful Australian poet, an autistic poet as well, Les Murray, who passed away a few years ago. And I knew Les personally and have translated some of his work into French. I've lived in France now for many years. And having written about Les and his autism and translated his work, Amanda reached out to me for her thesis. And we got talking and I realized what a wonderful mind hers was as well as Les's. And so one thing led to another and she kindly agreed to be part of the nine minds in the book.
What we've tried to achieve with the book, because it's a very sort of literary project rather than, you know, one often reads about ASD in various ways and in a kind of quite diagnostic sort of way. And this feels like something very different.
Yes, it is. And I'm glad that you felt that, because it was absolutely meant to be a literary object. It wasn't meant to be any kind of activist or medical or manual approach to autism, which is very much out there and has its virtues, of course, for many readers. But I wanted to do something different. I felt that, and still feel that, there's a big gap in bookshelves everywhere where these stories ought to be. And there's been a huge, obviously, movement in society over many years. We've seen it in different populations, whether it's women writing more and being read much more and much more seriously, LGBT writers and readers, Black and Asian communities as well. The neurodivergent population has its own stories to tell. And I felt that this would be an opportunity, this book, to tell those stories, often for the first time.
Do you feel like there is a sort of commonality, I mean, apart from obviously at the absolute top level, neurodivergence itself, is there a commonality, do you see, or ways in which the nine stories speak to each other? I mean, do you see a kind of like a thread in a way, or is the purpose of the book to say, look, these nine are entirely different, and that's, you know, divergence within neurodivergence?
Yeah, well, they are very different. So it goes all the way from a non-verbal, the story of a nonverbal man, an American called Billy. So that's obviously one end of the spectrum. And it goes all the way to Nisha Dolan on the other end of the spectrum, who's a very verbal person, obviously a novelist in her own right. So there is that diversity there. And at the same time, there are multiple threads as well, I feel. Creativity is one. These are individuals that are very creative, very imaginative often. And that's interesting in itself, because for many years, autism was considered something that was an obstacle to any kind of creativity, real creativity or imagination. And that's not the case at all. I'm sure it's a different kind of imagination than we see in neurotypical individuals. perhaps more visual, perhaps more intuitive, but it exists. And it was, you know, important for me to showcase that within the stories.
I'm interested in what you say about the creativity aspect, because Misha Dolan, I was kind of surprised. You know, I was thinking these are sort of not very well-known people I was going to be looking at, and it's like, oh, you know, she's all over the bestseller list. But the way you describe her approach to writing, you know, and as a writer yourself, does her sort of neurodivergent condition essentially shape her prose style or approach to prose? I mean, she's extraordinarily sentence level.
Yes. It was really interesting for me writing that essay, that portrait of Nisha, because being a writer myself and being on the spectrum myself, I was interested to see how close our experiences as autistic writers matched. And in fact, what was most interesting to me was how different they were in some ways. I'm a very visual thinker, and Nisha appears to be as well to some extent, but in different ways. She has a very powerful relationship to words, which I also have, being that I'm synesthetic, so I see words in colors and textures, for example. Nisha doesn't, as far as I know, but she does experience words in a way that's very, she's very attached, yes, to sentences as objects in her own right, and to wanting to make each sentence sing, and rather than try to work with a bigger picture approach, something like plot and characters, and she's more interested in putting words together in ways that are playful and interesting, original. And in doing so, she's somehow able to make plot grow out of the interactions between the words and between the sentences and between the paragraphs. And that's a very interesting approach, which very detail-orientated approach, which I have to some extent. But at the same time, being that I'm also very visual, probably also because of my synesthesia, when I'm writing, I do see. So, for example, writing about Nisha at school or at the university debating club, or her relationship with Sally Rooney, who was a classmate at university in Ireland, I was able to visualize these scenes, and it felt natural and useful for me to do so. And so it was very interesting for me to see that wasn't how Nisha approached text.
I mean, in terms of your approach to text, it feels like at quite a sort of granular level, you're adopting the idioms of the people you're writing about. I mean, you really are trying to ventriloquize them in some sense. How did you go about that? How easy was that? Because, I mean, you know, there's certain cadences that are distinctively Irish when you're writing about Nisha. And, you know, you've got a struth when you're writing about your Australian. And, you know, I it feels as if there's a certain amount of, you know, kind of dropping away of yourself and inhabiting their cadences.
Yes, exactly. That was my ambition as a writer. As a novelist does, when he or she inhabits a character or characters and a time and a place, which is, you know, specific to a text. That was my ambition, to take these nine lives and to inhabit each of them, which is something that we can do as writers. Actors, when they learn text and perform on stage, I mean, in films, they have that opportunity as well. It's a wonderful experience, and it's wonderful to be able to transmit that to and convey that to readers as well. I was playing with the English language itself because it's a very diverse language. So you have people in the book from Australia, as you mentioned, from Nigeria, from America, Canada, Ireland, the West Midlands, Wales. So there's a huge amount of diversity there as well. And I was, for each character, inhabiting them and inhabiting their English as well. Whenever their first language obviously was English, which in most of the cases was, you know, the case. So the most stories, English is the first language. But it's a different English in the same way that it's a different autism. It's a different form of neurodiversity in each story. And so I wanted the diversity in English to mirror that diversity within the spectrum as well. And then, of course, you have other individuals whose first language isn't English, like Kana, the Japanese woman who has become a researcher in psychology. Very interesting story about her approach to solitude, for example, loneliness, having created a whole scale to measure and universalize this very personal experience, which is very deeply felt among people on the spectrum. Even though for many years, as the story explains, scientists rather foolishly imagined that autistic people were never lonely, just because they assumed they were so much in their own headspace that they never felt the need for social contact, which is quite the opposite of what is the human experience of most autistic men and women. So yes, I wanted to inhabit those stories, showcase that diversity, and language was a good way of doing that.
Well, I mean, you touched on a couple of things. You know, in itself, your act of ventriloquism seems to be a rebuttal to the kind of vulgar idea that autistic people struggle with empathy. And as you say, for a long time, there was an assumption that autistic people couldn't be lonely or wouldn't be or would prefer solitude. Can you explain, and I know it's a big ask, you know, what your understanding of autism is, your experience of it yourself, and, you know, whether there are things that we can kind of pull together to say, this is what you think it is, and this is what it actually is.
Yeah. It's a big ask as well, because as you say, it's something that's very complex. It's very, and it's something that's moved a lot. I'm in my mid-40s now. I was diagnosed 20 years ago on the autistic spectrum. Back then, the word neurodiversity didn't exist. There are very few people writing who were on the spectrum, and those who were, often their books were ghostwritten or at least significantly rewritten. I'm thinking of Temple Grandin, for example, a wonderful life story and a remarkable career in animal science. And one of the first people to speak publicly about her autism back in the 80s when I was a child. But I was back then, I had epileptic seizures, as many unfortunately do on the spectrum. I was very different to my classmates, my siblings. I'm the eldest of nine children. So I had a lot of stimulation growing up. I probably benefited a huge amount from that early life stimulation. But I didn't have a diagnosis for many years. Many reasons for that, partly because the understanding that scientists had of autism in the 80s and 90s was very different back then, was very much focused on the most extreme forms of autism, the kinds that many people still automatically think of when they hear the word autism. So, for example, the stereotypical boy who is completely cut off from the world, doesn't speak, doesn't have seem to have any, you know, desire for social interaction, any imagination. And so as science caught up gradually with the reality of autistic lived experience, the fact that there were different forms of autism and different manifestations of it, and in some people there isn't a language delay, there isn't a problem with mobility and social interaction, there are difficulties or deficits, but they can be compensated for, they can be managed. In many ways, it can be an invisible disability.
You say disability because we, on the one hand, there's the language of neurodiversity, but we still diagnose it as ASD, autism spectrum disorder. Is that something that you buy into, or do you think that's the wrong way of looking at it?
Well, I'm always a little bit wary about medicalizing the complexity of people's lives, and particularly their inner lives. And so words like disorder don't speak to my experience particularly, and probably don't speak to the experiences of the people portrayed in the book. But there is clearly a disability. For many years, I wasn't able to look people in the eye. I wasn't able to understand social interactions very well. I struggled at school to make friends for many years. I've been very lucky as a writer to, you know, be able to live full time and write full time and live from my writing. But otherwise, I've never had stable employment. Many people on the spectrum are under or unemployed, despite having, in some cases, quite remarkable cognitive and perceptual and other abilities. So it can be a handicap. The question is, to what extent is it biological, and also to what extent is it social and cultural? And the book also addresses, not in any kind of scientific way, but just by reading the stories and seeing how they vary from place to place and time to time. When you see Dan Aykroyd, this amazingly gifted comic actor, and how he would have struggled in the 50s and 60s in Ottawa in Canada growing up, and how certainly that forged his comic genius in some ways, but it is obviously what can't have been easy at all, and must have left quite profound scars. And that was obviously also the experience of another man who's now in his 70s, portrayed in the book, Vaughan, the hand surgeon, who was quite traumatized, in fact, by his very buttoned up, stiff upper lip 1950s education and the awful beatings he suffered at school at a time when, unfortunately, that was, I imagine, quite widespread.
It seems like that trauma actually isn't distinctive to his autism, though, is it? I mean, that's...
No.
You know, there's a sort of generation for whom that's a...
Exactly. But it's interesting to see how these experiences impinge on individual lives, autistic lives, and how, in some cases, I mean, people were beaten terribly at school, unfortunately, but managed to come out of that not, you know, relatively unscathed, I hope, for most people. Whereas for Vaughan, it was incredibly sensitive and struggled a great deal with his sense of self for many years, and knowing that he was so different, not knowing why he was so different, and lost even the power of speech at one moment. He was hospitalized, he was institutionalized for a time because of his enormous problems of depression, and was very lucky to be befriended by a fellow doctor, a psychiatrist, who recognized in him a huge potential as a fellow surgeon and doctor, and, you know, was able to take him under his wing and help him to, on the long, you know, and difficult road to recovery. So yes, I wanted to portray all of that complexity, that lived experience complexity, not show autism as a condition itself. I mean, it's so complex. I think the best way to understand it is simply to look at the width and breadth of the spectrum as lived experience within these nine lives. And that's where literature comes in, because I feel like when we tell stories, that's how we best understand our fellow human beings. When we tell stories and we tell them well, we use all of the resources that literature gives us as writers, characterization and scene setting and dialogue and so on. It enables readers who are not autistic. Most of the readers of Nine Minds are not going to be autistic on the spectrum at all, but they are curious, they're open-minded, they're readers of Oliver Sacks, for example, and all kinds of other wonderful writers who were able to get inside other minds and other lived experiences and to portray them in a way that neurotypical readers can relate to. And it opens a window not only onto autism, but which is the much larger ambition of the book, onto what it is to be human, quite simply, which is, you know, the universal theme of all literature, really.
To come back to this idea, we talk about the spectrum.
Yeah.
How helpful is that as a metaphor? Because I think, you know, one sort of has the idea with a spectrum that you're talking about, in a sense, a sort of a degree of the same thing.
Yes.
You know, the wavelength of light changes and that generates the spectrum. But what you're describing is something that seems to be not... I mean, there are degrees of disability in the book, in the sense that, as you say, Billy is, for quite a lot of his life, nonverbal. And, you know, Nish Dolan is very much verbal. Dan Aykroyd is very verbal.
Yes.
But are we looking at degrees of the same thing? I mean, are they... is there a commonality, or is it just more wild than that, in your view?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Part of me would say that there's a certain element of degrees to it. We can understand it to some extent in terms of degrees. So Nisha is obviously has a, so to speak, a degree of verbal capacity, which is obviously much, much greater than that of Billy's, but also that of perhaps other people in the book. Vaughan, the surgeon, who's very gifted with his hands and with his visual skills, his ability to visualize in his mind in three dimensions, all of the different bones and arteries and the ligaments and the muscles in the human hand and the wrist and the arm and so on. But he speaks very little. He's not much of a talker, and he struggles to, I mean, he can. Obviously, we spoke for many hours, as I did with, apart from Dan Aykroyd, for whom it was impossible to get directly, you know, but I had instead many anecdotes from his family, his particularly his childhood friends and the people who grew up with him. But outside of Dan Aykroyd, all of the people spoke with me for many hours. So, obviously, with the exception of Billy as well, for whom it was a case of speaking with his mum in particular, Eve. And the story of Billy's is much her story as well, and the story of raising a nonverbal child in the teeth of a lot of misunderstanding from the part of doctors and scientists at the time. You know, we're talking about the 1990s, for example. So again, going back to my own childhood, adolescence, a time when autism was nowhere near understood in the way that it is today. And having said all of that, I also feel that it's also, we can't just say it's about a question of degrees. The autism in each case is different. It's different because the neurobiology is so different. And this is where culture and society comes in as well. A child raised in Japan, as is the case of Kanner, or in France, as is the case of Cedric Villani, the mathematician and politician, their stories are so, you know, necessarily very different to those of Vaughan and Billy and others raised in Britain and the US and Canada. And certainly culture and language and it's just, you know, the society norms in each of those places is a significant factor as well. And that's not just then a question of degree, but also the nature itself of autism, how we understand autism, depending on the time and the place.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, for a lot of people of our generation, you know, that Dustin Hoffman movie, Rain Man, was the sort of defining beginning of our understanding of autism. How kind of helpful was that, or otherwise?
Well, I do remember watching Rain Man on TV when I would have been about 10.
Had you been diagnosed at that stage?
No, I hadn't. So I was a child when it came out. I would be diagnosed in my 20s, so quite a few years later. Back in the 80s, 90s, very few diagnoses available for people on the spectrum who weren't non-verbal, who weren't, you know, profoundly handicapped. And that in spite of my epileptic seizures, so as a child, for example. But yeah, I remember watching with my parents and feeling both, yeah, there was a kind of, I felt a little bit close to the character portrayed by Dustin Hoffman insofar as I could relate to some of those behaviors, some of those obsessions and what I prefer to call passions for books in particular, for example. One of the things that probably really helped save me in a way from what might have been the prison of autism, because reading allowed me to learn about empathy. You mentioned empathy earlier, and reading was a wonderful way for me into other people's minds, into other people's lives, learning to read, to literally read other people's thoughts on the page and to better understand and learn how to adapt and relate to other people as a result of all of that reading growing up. But watching Rain Man now with hindsight, it's a mixed experience, because on the one hand, of course, it's very sensitively portrayed in some respects. They're wonderful actors, both of them, Hoffman and Tom Cruise. But it's very much a caricature of autism. And it's interesting that the person behind the story, Kim Peek, the man who inspired Dustin Hoffman's character, who I got to meet many years ago in Utah, where he lived with his dad, Fran, was not autistic at all. He was born with a part of his brain missing, which gave him quite unusual cognitive abilities, but profound disability at the same time. So he was certainly a savant.
But he wasn't autistic. That's extraordinary. The one thing that everyone thinks they know about autism is based on a film based on somebody who wasn't autistic at all.
Exactly.
That is quite extraordinary. Now, as you say, you know, some of these people found you, some of them you found. I mean, I think Kanner, you saw something about publication of her work and you worked with her. But I'm interested, your final chapter is about Dan Aykroyd, you know, famous actor. He wouldn't talk to you. And obviously some of his friends and family did. What made you want to do one where you weren't, as it were, in direct dialogue?
I mean, maybe he's responded to the book or seen the book, you could tell me, but... The book hasn't come out yet in the States and Canada. It comes out next April. But there have been some reviews of the book stateside already. One of them is by Tyler Cohen, I believe his name is, The Economist, who is autistic. And very popular stateside, apparently, and loved the book, felt it was very faithful to autistic experiences. So obviously that was quite heartening to see and to read. But otherwise, we'll have to wait and see if Dan Aykroyd gets around to reading it and reacts to it at all. He's a very private man. I was aware of this before I began writing about him. I did approach him because I felt it was essential to at least approach him with the project and see whether or not he would in any way feel like contributing. But for many years, he hasn't contributed to any project around his life story, which is understandable. He is, as I mentioned, a very private, very discreet man. And it was interesting going back, reading the interviews and seeing interviews he's given in media over the, you know, he's been in the public eye for something like 50 years now. And he's always been that way. He's always been rather unlike his peers in Hollywood, much more, I mean, he's a very verbal person. He talks a great deal when he gets going about one of something that he's particularly passionate about, you know, aliens or ghosts or guns or whatever it is. You know, he can talk for Canada and he gets going. But when it gets to anything particularly personal, that he kind of clams up. It's not something he's comfortable talking about so much, which is, you know, not my experience, not the experience of many other people on the spectrum, but it's his experience and I respect that totally, of course. But it was too much of an opportunity to miss to write about because his story is fascinating and it's not something that has been talked about previously, even though he is such a famous individual. And it just seems to be such a wonderful rebuttal to the kinds of cliches that still haunt, you know, a lot of research, a lot of conversation around autism, about the lack of supposed lack of creativity or invention or imagination, or and to see someone who is so fantastically creative and imaginative and successful as a screenwriter as well as an actor, comic actor, it's really interesting to portray that. And to the other point in your question, it was really interesting as well to write without his direct input, simply because it gave me a free hand as a writer, which I didn't have for the other portraits. I was careful to show what I was writing to the individuals. Obviously, I wanted to be as true to their experiences as possible, for there to be no errors as far as possible, obviously, in what I was writing about them, because it's so intimate and because some of the experiences are so powerful, so traumatic. But in the case of Dan, a lot of it is on public record. You know, the broad lines of his personal life is, and he has talked about it in some podcasts recently. As he got older, he seems to have become much more comfortable talking to a small extent about his childhood. And so I drew on a lot of those interviews that are already out there. But a lot of it is also based on my talking, as you mentioned, to his childhood friends and to the colleagues who worked with him at the very beginning of his career, pre-stardom in a way. And that's something that hasn't been published before. And I thought that was a side of him that would be very interesting to fans and just to anyone who appreciates his film. I mean, there's a whole generation, probably two generations now, who have grown up with Ghostbusters and other films, Blues Brothers and so on, by Dan Aykroyd. So it just seemed like it would be a wonderful way of closing the book.
Yeah, indeed it was. Did you give your subjects, my friend Alexander Masters writes biographies where he essentially gives his subjects right of veto. You know, he says, but I'm not going to publish this unless you're happy with that. Did you take the same view here?
Yes. To individuals who aren't public figures. So of the nine minds, six of them are not public figures. There's Nisha Dolan, obviously the novelist. There's Cedric Villani, the mathematician and politician in France. And then there's obviously Dan Aykroyd. But other than those three, the six others are all remarkable individuals,
incredible life stories, but they're not public figures. So it was important for ethical and legal reasons as well to give them that veto. So they were able to see the drafts of their portrait and to give their feedback, which was really helpful because, you know, it allowed me to be confident in knowing that what I was doing was true to their experiences. And at the same time, as a writer, you always want to have as free a hand as possible. And this was the first time where I didn't entirely have that free hand. You know, I've written essays in the past and where I've interviewed people, but I've not had to show them the copy afterwards. Journalists often, you know, mostly work that way as well. And so there was a small amount of frustration as well on not having a freer hand. But at the same time, it allowed me that access to their intimate inner lives, which I wouldn't have had otherwise, because they wouldn't, without that veto, I doubt they'd have been comfortable speaking to the as freely and as openly as they did.
That sense of structure in it. Quite often, you know, these are not straightforwardly chronological. You'll find a point or an image and you'll come back to it. What were you aiming to do there? Were you trying to produce a portrait of their minds rather than their lives, as it were?
A bit of both. I mean, obviously, their minds are their lives, you know, their inner lives, which is the subtitle of the book, Inner Lives on the Spectrum. That seemed to me what is missing in literature at the moment, any kind of insight into autistic neurodivergent inner lives, how these individuals think and feel and perceive the world around them and their perspective on the world, so that readers, most of them are not going to be on the spectrum, but will come to this book, I hope, and to these stories to have this point of view, this perspective that they don't find anywhere else, and which gives them a new window on to society, to their own humanity, a different way of seeing themselves and seeing society and the world around them, in the way that Toni Morrison, when she wrote her novels long before she got the Nobel Prize, was writing not only for Black, you know, African-American readers, women readers. She was writing to an experience and for readers wanting to draw on that experience, that lived experience, in order to see the world in a new way. And that's, you know, also what, for example, Alan Hollinghurst does when he's writing his gay, so to speak, his gay novels. But it's not only aimed at gay readers, obviously, but anyone curious enough to open a work of literature and wanting to experience the world in a new way, using a new perspective. And so I wanted these stories to, both in their content and in their structure, to help readers see the world in a new way.
And you've talked about how society, I mean, you know, you mentioned Kana, who's a researcher into loneliness in Japan, a country that's notoriously got sort of epidemic of loneliness. How much does culture, in your mind, determine the outcomes for people born with ASD?
It was fascinating speaking with Kana because I don't know Japan very well. I don't know any Japanese apart from a few words. I love Japanese readers, Kawabata and Mishima and Tanizaki, among others. But I don't have that insight into contemporary Japan. And Kana's story was really eye-opening for me when she explains how little autism is understood even to this day, to the extent that she had to go to the United States. She did her degree in the United States, post-doctoral research in the UK, in London, afterwards. And it was while she was a student in the US that she was finally diagnosed with autism. Because growing up, she was very different to the extent of not feeling Japanese at all. She preferred learning English and even to the extent of thinking in English, which is something which I, an experience which I feel, and many people on the spectrum feel very, we can relate to that very much. You know, one of the big reasons why I am in France, I've lived in France for many years, writing both English and French, is because of that feeling of foreignness growing up in England and English, and wanting, as soon as I could, as a young adult, to move overseas and to speak every day in a different language. And so Kana's experience
I could relate to, and at the same time, it was very different. So, and culture was a big part of that difference. So the fact that, quite a funny anecdote, when she would look people in the eyes in Japan, she was told off for doing so because it's the opposite of how we're raised in the West. Children are raised to look people in the eye, and particularly adults, teachers and parents in the eye. And in Japan, it's quite frowned on, in fact, to do this. You're meant apparently to keep your gaze somewhere around the neck and not to raise your eyes necessarily to the other person's eyes. It's considered aggressive or too intrusive. And so that was really interesting for me, for whom eye contact growing up was, like, for many on a spectrum, sometimes a struggle. And so that's one very clear example of the extent to which autism is both a neurobiological condition, but it's also a cultural construct to some extent as well, how we conceive society and people's roles in society, how sociable they should be, how much they should use language and in different ways, pragmatic ways, social ways, how, to what extent we should let people have their passions, as I call them, their obsessions, as other might say, so long as they're useful to themselves and to society in some ways. You know, Kanner's research led to, you know, quite interesting insights into loneliness, both for autistic adults, but for people everywhere. It's a universal experience. Dan Aykroyd's fascination with ghosts obviously led him to become the film actor and starlet he became. Vaughan's fascination with geography extended to the geography of the human body and to his gift for surgery. So we can see how these gifts, if they are encouraged, if they're valued, if they're, you know, allowed to take center stage over and above whatever eccentricities we might perceive in the individuals, that should be the focus of society's approach to autism, seeing what autistic people can do and do very well in some cases, many cases, rather than what they can't do.
Dan Tammet, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you.
Nine Minds, Inner Lives on the Spectrum is out now.